Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to the New Books in Sociology podcast on New Books Network. Hi, I'm Deidre Tyler, the host of the channel. Today, we'll be talking with Dr. Davis, the author of Flint's Journey from Crisis to Recovery, Tainted Tap. Hello, Dr. Davis.
Hello, Dr. Tyler.
I wonder if you could begin by telling us a bit about yourself and how you began the book project.
Well, I am a Flint native, and when I say Flint native, I was born and raised in Flint. I began this book project in 2011, and this is when I was finishing up a study on transit workers. And so right at the end of the study, I said, okay, now I can really go for my dream study, which was on Flint. I study resilience. I care about what groups, people, Black folks in particular, have to go through to just get things done. And so it's not always easy to find the right outcome, right? You know, so if you care about resilience, you know, it's sometimes we get some sort of environmental injustice to study, but it's not always something very, very concrete, like the Warren County protest or something like that. You know, we have to find these studies. And so what I ended up doing, I waited years to find an angle for Flint. Because it's, you know, it's always been a really interesting place to me. In fact, I wanted to replicate the Detroit area study. And so I walked around, I hung around Ann Arbor for about 6 months, really thinking about the approach to this project. At that point, it was just about essential services, namely police support, public safety. How are those services, shaped by community action on this, on sort of just getting their streets patrolled or their 911 calls addressed, and what happens when, you know, none of those things are happening. How are people pushing back? And so I was in a space where I was looking at Flint in terms of how things had declined over time because of General Motors and other companies sort of abandoning Flint, how things declined because of depopulation. And how things declined primarily because the state of Michigan decided to take away sales tax from many of, or its municipalities. And so Flint lost over, I think about 10 years, the $55 million in funds that would ordinarily get used to deal with essential services. And so again, when I was looking at this topic starting around like 2011, I was in a space where, again, looking at a broke city, right? They're not gonna, you know, really come up. Those approaches were, let's put a casino there. Well, that's not gonna work for a place like Flint. They tried it in Detroit, that barely worked, right? And so basically, you know, what are people doing with what they have? So fast forward, I'm going through whatever I can with regard to archives, public documents, et cetera, regarding the city of Flint. I get a phone call from a family member who says, the water is bad. And I did my own search, and sure enough, people were saying the water was bad, and they were saying nobody was doing anything about it. And so I waited until the end of the academic year, and I jumped on a plane and, you know, headed to Flint to interview some folks about the water. When I spoke with them, and, you know, I'm speaking with leaders, people who had sort of who had complained about the water, who had started town meetings, and also other leaders who care about the community. And so after I heard from them and we chopped it up about the situation, I just, you know, I became more intrigued by the topic, but I didn't really get, drawn in until they tried to play me. See, when they tried to play me is when I'm just looking up the public data, you know, just trying to figure out, okay, if there's blood lead poisoning in Flint, we're supposed to see it to some degree with this public health data. And then I noticed that Flint happened to, when they were listing the public health data, they happened to couple various zip codes in Flint. And again, as a Flint native, I know that there are qualitative differences in these zip codes. So long story short, you're not really telling anybody anything. And then in addition to that, I just began to become concerned about, well, if person X is complaining and we're not hearing it on the news, who else is complaining, and how big of an issue is this really? And so then I, you know, because I'm a nosy person, I start sending FOIA requests, and I started, you know, I continue to be in contact with the people in Flint. Long story short, again, there was pushback, not really wanting to give me the complaints. And then by that point, I had, you know, dug in my heels. I was going to go my route with regard to studying this topic. And then I began filling out formal IRB requests, et cetera, to really look at the data and get my hands on all of the public data that I could. And so then I went into the mode of doing a deeper search in terms of looking at which agencies I needed to contact to look into this topic. And so that's a long thing that I shared there. But essentially, they played Flint. I found out about it, and then they tried to play me, and then I wrote a book.
You know, that's a great story, because it's just telling us the importance of people doing research and community connections that are so important. Because if you had not grown up there, do you think you would have had that inside track?
Absolutely not. Absolutely not.
Now, you know, you talked about in your book about the model cities era.
Yes.
Tell us about life as a Black person during that time.
Ooh. See, folks in Flint, they were, you know, somewhat in a better space. Many people had come up from the South, right? And so and this is in search of GM jobs. And so they came into a better situation, right? At the same time, it was better economically in terms of being or having access to jobs that could pay better wages. However, the social environment was not welcoming at all, right? The same white immigrants or white natives they ran into in the South were the people they ran into in the North. And there was the same concern, essentially, I don't want to live around you. I don't want to share my resources with you, etc. And so Black folks dealt with a lot of discrimination. They dealt with a lot of they dealt with the reality of economic bars and that in job bars. So there were certain jobs that they could have within GM and certain jobs that they could not gain access to. And their environment was incredibly marred with disorder or not disorder, blight. Let's be clear. Sometimes we confuse the realities of poor folk with deficits, shortcomings on their part, etc. So no, we're talking about blight that was left behind because the city did not take care of their side of the area, and you know there was generally slow maintenance efforts. If maintenance happened at all. For instance, I remember writing about one neighborhood in Flint that became one of the areas covered by the Model Cities program. And, you know, this area basically had homes that were recently built, but those homes were so poorly constructed. You know, essentially things were falling off of the homes. There were no doorbells. You know, and at that time, if in addition to having homes that were essentially crumbling and really couldn't, you know, these homes were crumbling. They really couldn't really support the families that lived within them. It's important to note that at that time, there were two or three families living in one home. So not only were the homes poorly, you know, constructed, there are several families living there. The neighborhoods were underserved. The people were harassed. They were restricted heavily. Black life was difficult in Flint and elsewhere at this time. And so the Model Cities program came into being to give people some life, give them access to services. That program was about empowerment. It was really about empowering our neighborhoods that were left behind by our so-called urban renewal plan for the 1940s. You know, and so these neighborhoods that were destroyed because highways were built right through them, those were the neighborhoods that were targeted by the Model Cities program. And so I started this book with that moment in Flint because, you know, here we are. We had an opportunity to clean up the mess, clean up what racism did, what classism did, right? The clean up the product of opportunity hoarding in that space by extending opportunity to jobs, giving residents a voice in their community, allowing them to vote in people who represented them, who would then have a voice in how the city functioned, right? They patrolled their communities. It was such a thorough program, but ultimately it was pie in the sky because the structure couldn't handle that promise, right? Racism on the ground wouldn't let up. The stakeholders at the time didn't want there to be an expansion in opportunity. So that effort essentially failed, but that effort birthed many groups. Now, and I don't want to say people didn't fight in Flint before then, right? There were many of, you know, Flint has a long history of fighting back in being in a community that cared about its people and that advocated for itself. But during this particular period, Black clubs, I mean, we basically went from a few hundred to almost a few thousand, right? And this is just over time. We're seeing this manifest. We're seeing concerned citizens groups emerge. You know, there was a concerned citizen group about the north end of Flint. Then there's somebody concerned about this. So they named their concerned citizens of X. These groups were popping up left and right. And so I wanted to start there because although that Model Cities program was a failure, right, in that it did not empower the citizens as the policy makers envisioned, right? But it was successful in sort of setting up those concerned citizens groups in Flint, giving them a voice. And in with that, you know, we began to sort of see these groups in their efforts over time. And so I wanted to make sure that we were clear that Flint has always been busy advocating for itself. The water crisis is just one incident, one chapter in the city's history.
Yes, and you talked about the school integration and what happened with the teachers, the Black teachers in particular. Mm-hmm. Describe that a little more.
Well, what was happening during that time, the city of Flint was really supported by the Mott Foundation. The Mott Foundation was influential in helping the city develop its community education initiative, which was really something extraordinary and different. I mean, nationally, people would come to Flint to study how Flint delivered its education. And how what was this all about? Essentially, the purpose of the community education was to educate the entire family. And so you could very well, you know, schools were open in some cases until 10 or 8 to 10 at night, because there would be after-school opportunities, teen clubs, vocational opportunities for parents within these schools. And, you know, every neighborhood had a school, right? During this time, despite all of that, that progressive thought, the stakeholders, the people that held the purse strings, Mott Foundation in particular, believed in maintaining racial segregation. And so you had Flint schools that were an example to the nation with regard to how education was being delivered, right? But it was not an example with regard to how resources were distributed across race groups. And so you would have teachers who were Black, and in some cases, it wasn't the case that all Black teachers went to the Black schools, but it was the case that was, you know, that was the general trend. But the other trend that's important to note, that the teachers that had the most training, the most experience, also, you know, went to schools that were on the outskirts of the community, or schools that were majority white. And so what had to happen, you know, there had to be a pushback some effort to change the environment, to change the atmosphere. Several moves were made. Lawsuits were filed. And essentially, you know, it took a consent decree to desegregate Flint schools. But this process didn't really sort of, progress, make any significant progress until the 80s. Because despite all of those efforts to desegregate schools where the children were predominantly Black, you know, those efforts weren't successful because people were so wed to their way of life. And in particular, the way of life that I'm referring to, keeping Black children from the best educational resources in the area. And so, again, that was not just about books. It was also about how teachers were distributed and how they were compensated and the extent to which they were given opportunity for advancement.
You know, you talked about the tale of two Flints. Describe that a little bit more when you were looking at the water situation and just living there in general.
It's really important that we get this piece because and I really love this question that you just raised, because a lot of the confusion at the start of the water crisis had to do with the fact that people had qualitatively different experiences because they lived in different places within the city. It's important to keep in mind that a place like Flint has been really undermined by uneven development. And so you will have a lot of interest in maintaining certain parts of the city, like the downtown area or the east, you know, side of the city. Meanwhile, the places where I was born or where I was raised, the north side, is abandoned, discarded, etc. In such that people, when there's a heavy snow, you can expect the streets to not get cleared. You can expect the police not to show up for 911 calls, etc. And so there are in these same places, we know, particularly now after work has been done to sort of look at or look for lead service lines, we know those same places where that have been discarded, where that didn't get the development, those places where the community, or rather the business community, abandoned, those places are heavily, those are the places where lead service lines are concentrated. Those are also the places where brownfields are concentrated, brownfield sites of contamination. And I should also say, those are sites where our water main breaks are concentrated. So those folk living on the parts of the city where the lead service lines have been replaced, right, years prior to some degree, and where people have a bit more money to work with, better resources to work with, they're saying when this water thing happens, what are y'all talking about? I don't see any issue with my water. And so, some sort of, tensions emerged within the community because there was a concern that people were just playing to the crowd. They were playing to the cameras when the cameras showed up, right? And they were just spinning this story and really making the city look bad. Like, how dare you say that the water was bad? You need to find something else to do with your time. In fact, there were people saying that folks, this is interesting here. In fact, there are people saying that people came in from out of town, professional protesters, right? And so, you know, again, people were making the claim that folks just didn't have enough to do with their lives. And those who weren't, you know, just busybodies, they were looking for attention. They were parachuting in just to, you know, catch a few, you know, interviews and leave the city. And so there was certainly a tale of two cities. And I think for the most part, if this were to happen in any other city, it would probably emerge in the same way, because people, they, you know, the spaces within any given city are likely very different. And this is all shaped by how we provide for the citizens in those spaces and the extent to which we value the people there.
Is Flint fixed?
Nope. No, Flint is not fixed. It is probable. Let me say it like this. Flint is not fixed, but Flint is on the mend, right? I just saw a YouTube clip put up by the city of Flint that stated its intentions to complete the lead service line replacement program, or its efforts, by the end of this year. But I should also be clear in stating that this was supposed to be done a year ago. And this process began in 2016, the process of even fixing the lead pipes. This city will likely continue to have problems even after it completes this program, or its efforts to replace the lead service lines, primarily because of how they approached this whole recovery. There were so many balls dropped, issues that emerged where I think the recovery process itself is tainted. And so not only will it take years, I think, to really complete the process, and that is fix the targeted parcels, deal with the water distribution system. And really, there should be a good look at the city's treatment plant. I think that's going to take some time. We're talking perhaps another 5 or so years, in my opinion, to really clear this out. But the whole battle to win the trust of Flint residents, that battle's going to last for years.
Well, we've taken up enough of your time. I've enjoyed the conversation. What are you working on next? What can the audience be looking forward to with your next project?
Well, I think for the most part, I intend to stay with lead poisoning to some degree. I really care about us getting this right. And for the most part, it's been hard to link the lead service line issue to blood lead contamination, primarily because we don't collect the data. And so my plan is to go in and look at various counties at the same time, so that, you know, there's a greater mass of people, because the data that we have to get our hands on is the data that looks at what's happening with kids under 1 year old. You know, we're biasing the data to some degree by looking at folks over one, who generally are not as reliant on water as those people under one, particularly babies who aren't bottle fed or who are bottle fed. And so the plan is to take a closer look at blood lead contamination and sort of built environment or factors in the built environment that cause those problems to continue. And then the other component of research that I'm going to move forward with is land dispossession. And these efforts throughout the country to create land banks. I'm wondering how these efforts are developing, if in whether or not they're developing like the land bank in Genesee County, Michigan, which is really the model land bank nationally. That land bank has its detractors. And so I'm very interested in seeing how this land bank compares to what we're seeing nationally.
Well, we'll be looking forward to your research. Thank you.